Hello and welcome to a special Brexpresso edition of Coffee House Shots. We are going to be discussing all the Brexit-related news in a particularly Brexit week. Today I'm joined by Liam Halligan, the Telegraph columnist and author with Gerard Lyons of Clean Brexit, and also Jonathan Portes, who's Professor of Economics at King's College London and author of a new book called Capitalism. So, Liam, let's start with you. It's been a week of talk of deadlock, headlines of clashes, prime ministers saying, not saying whether they would vote for Brexit if there were another referendum. Has there been any good Brexit news this week?
I think what is good news is that people are finally facing up to the fact that the most likely outcome, as I've said for many months, is that we get to March 2019 and we have no ratified free trade agreement with the European Union. It's good that we're discussing that because that means hopefully we'll prepare for it if somebody can kick the Chancellor in the shins. And actually, I'm completely relaxed about having no free trade agreement by March 2019 and trading under WTO rules. Most trade in the world goes on under WTO rules. Most of our trade, the UK's trade now, is largely under WTO rules. It's the part of our trade where we have a surplus. It's the part of our trade that's fast growing. And it's the majority of our trade. But we do have to prepare for WTO rules. There's physical and administrative and legal preparations to make which need to be done. But we need to realise that WTO rules will be just fine and will provide us a platform from which we can then strike a free trade agreement with the EU, which is the ultimate outcome. That's what I want overall. But without this sort of Article 50 sword of Damocles over our neck. A free trade agreement will be for the long term. We want to get it right. If it takes an extra couple of years beyond the cauldron of the madness of Brexit process itself, then that's fine by me.
Do you think this government is going to be capable of confronting that reality?
I think it must, because the reality is that to even when you're starting from a place of 100% compliance, as we are with the EU, striking a free trade agreement with the EU relies on the EU. And they just may not want to. The political chest beating and foot dragging may prevail over common sense and commercial logic. So a free trade agreement with the EU is in the EU's gift. So we need to prepare to not have one, not only for practical purposes, but also as a basic tenet of good negotiating. You've got to have an option. And what we need to do as a political class, and people that study these issues closely need to step up to the plate, is to decontaminate this idea. The Remainer lobby, which is very powerful and becoming more confident and better funded all the time, is determined to paint WTO rules as crashing out of the EU and a disaster. And it's complete nonsense. This is the system that governs the majority of trade in the world and the majority of our trade now. WTO rules are fine, but we do need to make preparations for them, and that means spending some money and putting some ministerial and civil service bandwidth towards that effort.
Jonathan, what do you think? Is it a case of we just need more bandwidth?
I mean, first of all, I think I should correct Liam's claim that we do the majority of our trade under WTO rules. That's wrong, as a matter of fact. About 44% of our exports and 53% of our imports come from the European Union. But then, of course, Norway and Switzerland, which are major trading partners of the UK, Switzerland's in the top 10, trade with us within the framework of the single market, in other words, effectively under EU rules already. And then when you add on countries which we've got, which the EU and which we have free trade deals with as members of the EU, that includes South Korea, includes Mexico, includes Chile, includes a whole bunch of African countries, you get up to about 60% of our trade that is not done under WTO rules. And that's before you even add in Canada. And of course, the EU-Canada free trade agreement came into force just a few weeks ago. So, you know, that's just a factual point. But more broadly, I think we need to distinguish between two things, which is the sort of long-term impact of moving to a situation where we don't have a free trade agreement with the EU, where we're trading under WTO rules, and the short-term impact of doing it on March 2019, the so-called crashing out, or what I've referred to as chaotic Brexit. And those are two different things. In the long run, there's an economic argument, discussion to be had, and there are arguments on both sides about what the impact would be of moving to WTO rules in the long run. In other words, of reimposing tariffs, reimposing regulatory constraints. Then there's the much more sort of practical short-run issue on which actually economists don't have that much to say about what happens to ensure that there aren't huge queues of lorries in Dover. The fact that on a non-trade issue, for example, more than a million Brits in the rest of Europe will overnight be thrust into complete legal limbo because they'll no longer be citizens of the European Union and hence they won't be protected under the individual legal frameworks of those 27 other member states. So all that sort of messy stuff. But it's quite important to distinguish between those two issues. It's perfectly reasonable.
But you actually think there's been progress on citizens' rights?
I think there has been some progress towards the deal on citizens' rights, yes. There are still issues outstanding and there's still the sort of whole overarching question about what precisely the judicial legal framework is, how we ensure effectively that we follow the ECJ rules while respecting the government's red line that the ECJ doesn't actually have direct control over our own courts. And I think that's ultimately squarable. It's not squared yet. But I think, you know, both sides want a deal on citizens' rights. They're inching towards it painfully slowly. But I do think there has been some progress on citizens' rights over the last few months.
Lynn, what do you think on citizens' rights? Do you think the EU been using it as a sort of cynical bartering chip?
Yeah, just to counter, if we're going to sort of
trade geekiness. Trade blows.
So the UK did 61% of its trade with the EU in 1999. It's now 44%, as Jonathan said. If you look in the national accounts, HMRC estimates that the so-called Rotterdam effect, where exports we send to Rotterdam actually go beyond the EU because it's Europe's biggest port, takes our EU exports to about 40%. But, you know, we can quibble, but the EU and the US, the US and China, China and the EU, the three biggest trading blocks in the world, all trade largely under WTO rules. This is not a chaotic outcome. This is not a disaster. Mm. Under WTO rules, Freddie, we will end up as net fiscal beneficiaries, given that we have a trade deficit with the EU. I presume you agree with that, Jonathan. Those tariff revenues, and they register somewhere between 3 and 6 billion, depending on your assumptions, could be used to help sectors that could be harmed by WTO rules adjust if the government so chooses to use that money in that way. On citizens' rights, I've written many times, not least in The Spectator, that I think the government has made a major strategic error here. Immediately after the EU referendum, and I think on this Jonathan and I do agree because I've followed his excellent analytical work on this. Immediately after the EU referendum in June 2016, when the world was looking at Britain thinking, are these Brits still as sort of tolerant and liberal and globally minded as we always thought they were? We should have unilaterally, Freddie, as a country, as a government, guaranteed the rights of the 3.1 million EU citizens living in the UK. That's what they want. It's what their neighbours want. It's what their employers want. They deserve to be here. They came here in good faith. The 1.3 million reciprocal Brits living in the EU, I personally believe the Commission would have been forced by moral opprobrium, international opprobrium, to immediately reciprocate. And anyway, this is a parlour game. All these rights are broadly guaranteed under the so-called Vienna Convention, where you can't penalise individual people because politicians, you know, change treaties that have previously been in force. We've allowed ourselves, just as we have allowed ourselves to be hoodwinked into this sequencing game, we've allowed ourselves to really be put on the back foot with citizens' rights. Everybody wants to guarantee these rights. And I'm afraid when the Prime Minister is asked on Ian Dale's radio show this week, Prime Minister, why don't you just guarantee these rights? And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are listening and thinking, yeah. And she says, Ian, let me get a bit technical with you here. No, wrong answer, Prime Minister. Just say, yes, we're going to do this. We're going to do this under British law. Are you telling me that Polish people living here don't want to have their rights guaranteed under British law? The world comes to the UK to resolve their differences. The idea that we can't uphold EU citizens' rights in the UK under British law is preposterous. The EU is now foot-dragging on this. There has been a little bit of progress, incremental progress, I agree, again with Jonathan, over the last week. But this is something that we should have biffed into touch very early in the negotiation, getting the moral upper hand with the Commission and not allowing them to portray the UK as mean-spirited and intolerant on this issue, because it just makes people that voted Remain, it makes them more queasy. It builds the sort of growing let's just rip it all up lobby in the UK.
Jonathan, what do you think about the sequencing and the Brexit bill? I mean, do you think this is parlour games, really, ultimately? Or should we be thinking in bigger, broader brushstrokes?
Well, a lot of it is parlour games and posturing, and there's obviously a bit of that on both sides.
Yes. The EU is far foot-dragging on this a lot more. Come on.
Well,
you know it is.
I mean, you know.
Be objective about it. We desperately have been trying to get this through, and the EU has tried to make it a question of ECJ jurisdiction.
Oh, sorry, are we talking about the citizens' rights?
Citizens' rights.
Oh, no, I mean, on citizens' rights, I agree with a lot of what you said. I think both sides could have easily made a high
level... Do you agree the Commission is dragging its feet more than the UK government on this issue?
No, I mean, we can get into the technicalities if you want, but
it's not technical, it's
well,
obvious.
I mean, so it's not obvious. So, for example, the UK is refused... So suppose you're a German national who's living here... and you have a your mother's...
Yeah. We want the rights of non-EU citizens and EU citizens to be the same, and that's completely fair. Otherwise, it breaches our own anti-discrimination laws.
So you're saying the German citizens should just shrug and say, yes, I accept the fact that I won't be able to bring my mum to live when she gets old?
No, I think...
But that's our current position, right?
Yeah, I think the British offer is extremely generous. It doesn't say if you haven't been here for 5 years, if you arrive before an as of yet unspecified cutoff date, then you have a chance, even the right, to build your 5 years until you get full leave to remain. That's astonishing.
Wait a minute. The current offer says to a German that you know, I'm a German living here. My mother is 65 now. She might want to come and live with me in 5 years if she gets ill.
Mm.
The UK saying, nope, sorry. When you came here, you knew that you could bring your mum here if you needed to, but we're taking that right away.
I would say, and we you and I are very close on this.
Yeah, no, I think
we really are. We
are
completely.
Let's
not get churlish about it.
I'm not disagreeing.
I personally think what the British government should do is uphold these EU rights completely unilaterally, including the spousal and parental stipulations that you say, in order to give these negotiations a real boost of adrenaline and say to the world, look, we want to do this. Will you stop messing about and playing human poker with people, Monsieur Barnier? Because it's so sad. I know there's such determination within the British government to do this, and you do too. But unless you're a complete political nerd, like all of us around this table, and possibly a lot of people listening to our wonderful, is it Brexpresso podcast, Freddie? good line.
Well done.
Then your general impression, if you read just the papers or watch the Tea Time News, is that Theresa May doesn't want to do this, but she does want to do it, so she should just do it.
No, I don't think we are having a substantive disagreement here. I agree. Both sides should just say, you know, there are a lot of legal technicalities to sort out. Both sides should just say, yeah, we want to guarantee other. We're making a clear political commitment. We'll let the lawyers sort out the details.
Can I do a bit of sequencing?
we want to move on to the broader question.
We haven't made sufficient progress.
I can see this is going to go round and round.
I'm willing to talk to you.
The bill.
Yeah.
You believe there will not. The Brexit bill will have to be paid in some way, and that the government can't sort of use it as a bargaining chip in the way that it is.
We can use it as a bargaining chip. What we can't do is using it as a bargaining chip for a future trade deal, because nobody seriously thinks we're going to have a future trade deal signed within 2 years. Mm. We can use it as a bargaining chip, and I think this is actually what the government intends to do. That's the implication of policy. We can use it as a bargaining chip to secure effectively a status quo transition, a transition whereby... and this averts the chaotic Brexit that I was talking about before. This gives us time to prepare, you know, customs officers at ports. It gives us time to introduce a new immigration system, time to deal with all the regulatory messes that will arrive. So what I think we're buying with paying an exit bill is this: we're not buying a future trade deal, and we shouldn't think about it as buying a future trade deal. We are buying a two-year grace period between 2019 and 2021, when we can deal with some of the sort of immediate consequences of a chaotic Brexit, and then work out what our future relationship is with the EU and our future trading relationship with the rest of the world. And I agree with Liam on a lot of things he says about that.
Liam, you roughly on the same page as far as the bill is concerned?
Outbreak of agree. We do agree on a lot of things, actually. So in my book with Gerard Lyons, Clean Brexit, we argue, as we argued in the original policy exchange paper at the end of 2016, for a transition period. And a transition period is actually allowed for in the Lancaster House speech, January 2017, and in the Article 50 letter, March 2017, and in subsequent speeches. So I'm actually quite reassured as a sort of citizen of the UK that you've got, you know, the likes of Amber Rudd and Liam Fox both relaxed about a transition agreement. I mean, that's quite amazing progress, actually. I don't think anyone except the most sort of, you know, hard-nosed Brexiteer doesn't accept there should be a transition agreement. Duncan Smith accepts there should be a transition agreement. That obviously we can quibble about if it's a transition period in which you move incrementally or an implementation period in which you're legally out and then you have a sort of memorandum of understanding.
Yes, do you think the term implementation is a mistake?
No, I think the term transition is a mistake, because a transition can be stopped. An implementation is a legal event has happened and you're implementing the implications of that legal event. And I agree with a lot of what Jonathan said. I think it's completely fair. We signed up to the MFF, the so-called EU seven-year budget, and we will be 5 years through it in 2019. I think I'm right in saying, Jonathan's nodding. Right, yeah. So there is an elegant solution where we pay for a couple more years in order to have a transition. My proviso would be that on the face of the bill, you have a leaving date and you know where you're going. So it's an implementation period, not a transition period. And you end up outside the EU single market and customs union. Because if you don't do that, you can't actually cut trade deals with the rest of the world because you've got nothing to bargain with because you're not in control of your own laws, trading regime and regulations. So as long as it's on the face of the bill, I think it's fine. But it's got to get to it gets to a point where you've got to say to the EU, we're not going to agree the money. We're going to agree to the principle of the money, and we've agreed that. And the threat we've got to put to the EU is, look, legally, we don't have to pay you anything, right? That's completely clear. They acknowledge that privately. If you don't move on and accept that we're going to do a deal on the exact amount at the end of the negotiating period, reflecting the goodwill and flexibility that you've shown, then we are going to put this question to arbitration. We're going to send this to the arbitration court at Hague, which isn't an EU body, and they're going to decide. And they will probably decide in our favour. And the EU knows that. So we should use that as a threat, this threat of putting this at arbitration unless we move on.
But again, with Philip Hammond now in Washington talking about...
at the bank fund meeting.
Britain. I mean, one of the sort of more strange and interesting stories I thought this week was this, I think, Liam Fox idea of Britain joining NAFTA. When I first heard that struck me as kind of Atlanticist pie in the sky thinking. But then if you think
somebody
about
who had a poster of Ronald Reagan on their wall as a kid, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, quite.
As you did.
Steady on. But I mean, I do think that when you start to think about it in a sort of future context, is it that mad an idea? I mean, one of Britain's issues is we have a very small negotiating team. So if it's possible to sort of kill three birds...
I think one of the major prizes of Brexit is outside the customs union, not only freeing us, our shoppers, from basically subsidising inefficient EU firms elsewhere through the common external tariff, that's a more technical point, but one of the major prizes of being outside the customs union is cutting our own free trade agreements. The EU isn't very good at cutting free trade agreements. It hasn't cut a free trade agreement with a major global top 10 economy in its 60-year history. It's just done Canada, that's right. No US trade deal, no China trade deal, which of course Switzerland has, Chile has, smaller countries.
And you put this down to just the problem of 27 agreeing.
27 dimension chess and just the sort of over-bureaucratisation of the Commission and its trade secretariat. But a major win for us under the customs union, and the government's really got to start talking about this, is getting together with like-minded countries, other massive service sector exporters like the US, and giving access to our markets, not least agriculture, but other areas as well, in return for services. Because the EU single market has discriminated against services. It doesn't exist for services. And within the WTO, services agreements have always got stuck. So the US and the UK, together with other like-minded nations, obviously the other English-speaking nations, but others too, a lot of developing and emerging markets, we can really push to free up service sector trade the way we pushed in the post-war period to free up goods sector trade, and at the same time really champion removing non-tariff barriers. Now, that all sounds quite arcane, but this is really the big prize from Brexit, that the UK, it's not pie in the sky at all. We can we already do more of the majority of our trade outside the EU. As I've said, the EU is now, when we leave, 15% of the global economy. There's a big world out there, and I think aligned with the US, and you know, Trump's not everybody's cup of tea, but if there is a business reason for doing a deal, he will do a deal. And the UK's got a lot of scope for piggybacking on those deals and even driving those deals.
Jonathan, what do you think about our scope?
I agree with a lot of the sort of philosophy there. I'm slightly more sceptical about the realism. I mean, I think, you know, Trump is currently trying to renegotiate NAFTA as we speak with the Canadians and the Mexicans in ways that will, and because Trump does, unlike Liam or me, see trade deals as being basically zero sum, he is talking about renegotiating in ways which will reduce trade and which will disadvantage Canada and Mexico, probably disadvantage American consumers as well, but he doesn't, not clear he understands or cares about that.
Well, we saw this week with Bombardier.
True. Well, that, I mean, that. So the first point is, I think the idea that at the same, we're going to expect that the US is going to expand NAFTA to include us in any way that would be, I think, politically or economically beneficial from the UK's point of view, I think is optimistic. Of course, Trump may not be there in 3 years. By the time we get to
I think he will be.
There's a separate discussion. Yeah, but, you know, one might hope that in the medium to the long term, the US will still broadly be a free trading nation.
You've got to distinguish between Trump's bombastic rhetoric, which is obviously playing to his Rust Belt audience, and one hopes the business-making acumen of himself and the people around him. If there are benefits to be had from the UK and the US doing a trade deal, or indeed the US joining, the UK joining NAFTA, which doesn't stop us joining other trade blocs around the world, joining an Asiatic trade bloc. I mean, that's the centre of the global economy for our kids and our grandkids, the Pacific Asian basin. And we're not there nearly as much as we should be, because EU trade deals haven't extended that far.
I mean, I think there is a lot to that, but just to put some of the other side. So, for example, China and Switzerland do have a trade deal. It's not a great deal from the Swiss point of view, and it certainly doesn't allow the Swiss financial services industry to do anything serious at all in China, despite the fact that obviously they'd like to. So the idea, I think, that the Chinese are going to say, yes, we'll accept, if you reduce the already relatively low tariffs on our manufactured goods, then your banks can come up and set up in China. Not happening, right?
I think that Swiss trade deal is instructive. I'm glad Jonathan brought it up. It was signed in 2013 after about 18 months to 2 years of negotiation. Obviously a much smaller economy, a top 20 global economy, a formidable economy. But they signed a trade deal. Chile signed a trade deal with China, of course. But we do have certain bargaining chips. You know, we are sitting in the world's financial capital. We do have Chinese banks who are desperate to establish themselves here. We do have, you know, now currency convertibility with the yuan via the Bank of England. We're one of the few places in the world where you can trade yuan outside the Chinese mainland. All these things are in place. We are a founder member of the AIIB, the big Chinese-run investment bank. We are a major global market. If the Swiss can get a pretty good deal, and it is a pretty good deal, the Swiss aren't going to sign anything that isn't pretty good. They're some of the best negotiators in the world. If they can get a pretty good deal in 18 to 24 months with the Chinese, then surely we can get a pretty good deal, maybe even a good deal.
And then, I mean, going to the point of, you know, is it the EU stopping us getting these deals or increasing our exports? So take India, for example, which was raised a lot during the campaign.
That's
going to be tough. And I'd make two points. First of all, I did see a bit of the EU-India negotiations when I was in government. And of course, I mean, there were three or four blockers. And, you know, the Indians are not easy to negotiate with at all. But one of the big blockers, frankly, possibly the biggest blocker from the EU side, was, of course, the UK. Because we don't like Indians. Theresa May, then Home Secretary, now Prime Minister, doesn't like immigrants. We have to get over that sort of... Liam's strategy to work, we have to get over that sort of hang-up.
I do think that's a little bit unfair. She was quite a tough Home Secretary. Then again, she was a woman making her way in a man's world, and she survived as Home Secretary, and that partly meant being maybe tougher than her sort of general character on this issue would make her be. I don't think she doesn't like immigrants. I just think at a time when EU immigration into the UK was spiralling, despite official estimates that it wasn't going to, after the accession of the A8 countries in Eastern Europe, at a time when overall immigration had gone up from 50,000 net in 97 to 350,000 net in 2015, as Home Secretary for quite a big chunk of that time, Theresa May, the only place that she could bear down on immigration, obviously because of freedom of movement with the EU, was the non-EU. Mm. Now, if we do have our own immigration controls, liberal yet measured and confidence-boosting immigration controls on EU trade, we can afford to deal with and negotiate on non-EU trade. And, you know, don't underestimate the importance to commercial India and sort of psychological India of this country. Obviously, our relationship with India, our history with India is complex. Our history with Ireland is complex. And I sit here as somebody of Irish origin. But it doesn't mean we don't do trade. And if we can, I think, take students out the numbers, we can, the immigration numbers, if we can get controls on EU immigration, I think it gives us confidence to do things like taking students out the numbers, which is good for our export of university service, which I know is very important to you, Jonathan, and to me, and we can do a deal with the Indians on highly skilled, high-tech and medical immigration. And there's no reason why we can't do that once we have control of the systems. We know who's in the country. Mm-hmm. And I think Brexit is a good opportunity to finally get our immigration system on, you know, organised in an adult way, that it gives confidence to British people if they've been here for one generation or 10.
Do you have any confidence in the political class to be able to do that?
I think it's difficult, but at least, even though Brexit has led to lots of bad-tempered dinner parties, and I've been at plenty of them myself. Mm. You know, a lot of my friends these days shop at Waitrose, right? And they don't like Brexit. On the other hand, we are getting to the point, I think, where, and I'm not just sort of being gratuitous here, where people like Jonathan, who've worked on immigration their whole careers, their work is getting better known. The numbers are now becoming common currency. We've broken the taboo. We can now talk about this, and hopefully as we go forward, we can begin to talk about it in a measured way. And I personally believe we should end up with like a monetary policy committee of immigration, where there's overall political control, but you have a group of people from government, economists, from industry, the trade unions, who every year look at the forecast produced by Jonathan and others at the National Institute and all the rest of it, and come up with a number that is measured, that reflects the needs in overall total and the sectors where we have labour shortages. And if the British public sees that happening, I think that is a lot more important to them, that there's a system that's fair rather than the actual headline number.
Mm. Jonathan, do you share any of that optimism about, or do you think we're entering into dark economic nationalism?
I agree with an awful. I mean, I disagree with some of the detail, but I agree with the broad, what Liam's saying in broad terms. I agree. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, anybody who makes, I'm not a political scientist or a political pundit, but what I can say is that, political scientists and political pundits haven't done terribly well in predicting the last couple of years, and no particular reason to. But I mean, I think, Liam is right that, Brexit potentially can be a reset moment for immigration policy. So, I think free movement was pretty good at, the numbers were significantly higher than anyone expected. But on the whole, it was beneficial economically and socially. But post-Brexit, we'll need something different. We'll need a new system, and that gives us an opportunity to have both to reset the political debate and to reset the system. And it's important that economists on all sides, whatever they think about Brexit, should put forward the case for
a lot of us Brexiteers are as liberal on immigration as you are, but we just feel that the system loses consent, and that's the key word, consent, unless there are visible controls and the parts of the country where the pace of change is fastest aren't ignored, as they have been.
I mean, I think my point would be that, look, once you're at, take Brexit as a given, then you have both the need and the opportunity to put to come up with a new system that replaces the one that we have now, which has freedom of movement within the EU. We won't be in the EU, so we need something to replace that. And we need to look at what the overall system looks like. There will be a big argument. There's always going to be an argument between people who are mostly economists who are at the more liberal end and people who are at the more restrictionist end.
Yeah.
The question is how you get that debate in a sensible way and you get away from some of the sort of scaremongering which you have about immigration, both in the EU context but also in the more general context.
But it's also a democratic issue in that, you know, you're talking about consent.
Absolutely.
And what you're really saying is, you know, are the people who voted for Brexit in agreement with the people who are delivering Brexit? You know, on something like immigration.
I think many people voted for Brexit for different reasons. Mm. We've discussed this over a long period, Freddie. I broadly voted for Brexit because on sort of democratic and sovereignty grounds, having seen the EU Commission work up close and personal over the years, I just think it's profoundly undemocratic.
Yes.
And I think the single currency was the step too far. It went beyond a trading zone and a zone of cooperation into something that is ultimately doomed, in my view, to implode, I'm afraid. I say that with regret. I think the single currency will eventually implode. But I think the British public voted for Brexit for many, many reasons. And I think most folk who were on the sort of more... their motives were more geared towards immigration... For most working class people, in my view, the issue with immigration isn't an issue of race, right? It isn't an issue of race. It's an issue of economics, and it's an issue of their skills that they have being countered. I mean, in the twilight of the labour market, it's very, very easy to get around the minimum wage. I mean, all you do is you hire folk who are maybe vulnerable. Immigrant backgrounds, and you just say verbally, or you get their friends to tell them, look, on paper, you're going to work for 40 hours and you're going to get this amount of money. And as far as the taxman's concerned, it's all there, it's all on paper. But you're only going to keep the job if you work for 60 hours. That's how it works. Okay, that's how it works. And it's an almost impossible to detect way of paying immigrant labour much lower than the minimum wage. And this is what, you know, often working class men who may be the sole earner in their household, feeling particularly financially vulnerable, who have certain manual skills, they're not unskilled, but they might be classified as unskilled, see extremely talented, extremely qualified people come and work for money, which is a multiple of the average wage in their home countries, but is way below the minimum wage here. And there's been an awful lot of that going on. And the immigration numbers that we've seen, say 350,000 net in 2016, you got to add to that people who got a new national insurance number but didn't stay a whole year. And that's, you know, another order of magnitude more, hundreds of thousands more. And if you are somebody who comes here to work in the construction industry or whatever it is every year, but you only stay 10 or 11 months, you could do that for 10 years in a row, but you don't count in the headline numbers.
Yeah.
And we've seen a lot of that in the UK. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. My family came from Ireland and did that. All I'm saying is we have to acknowledge that it's going on and allow for the fact that that makes a lot of people who lived here all their lives feel, understandably, extremely vulnerable.
Jonathan, you were saying you think it could be a chance to reset. Could this be sort of the last chance to reset a liberal attitude on immigration, given...
I mean, we've been arguing about immigration in this country in, you know, even... leaving aside the long history, but, you know, we've been having political arguments in Parliament about immigration since the 1905. Well, since Parliament began, but, you know, in sort of modern history since the 1905 Alien Immigration Act, when they were worried about Jews in the East End. So, you know, we're going to carry on arguing about it for the foreseeable future. And you just as well carrying on arguing about what the tax system should look like or how much people who are unemployed.
This is the stuff of politics,
this is what politics is about.
But let's argue about it in our Parliament and decide in our Parliament what the rules are.
Well, I think, you know, Brexit...
You can't do that in the EU.
That's right. I mean, that is, and that was, you know, I mean, not for everybody, but was one of the fundamental drivers for the vote was that...
And let's argue about state aid in our parliament, and regional policy in our parliament, and trade policy in our parliament.
Being part of the EU means that you lose control over some things. Mm. You know, I'm not a sovereignty absolutist myself, but, that...
Let's do trade deals, you secede sovereignty.
But on that, that clearly was a big element. So, yes, we, for better or worse, and it could be either, we get back the right to have a considerably greater degree of control over our own immigration system, and it's up to us how we use that, and it's up to people who believe in a sort of broadly liberal managed approach to migration to try and put the case to why that's a good thing. And that does mean I don't agree with everything Liam said about the negative effects at the bottom end. I think they're pretty small, actually, as far as we
they're
can
small
tell.
On average, but people don't live in averages. People live their own lives.
That's true, but small on average still means that the number of people who are really adversely affected, as far as we can tell, just isn't that great.
I think
unless you think that
before,
people are
before
on
we
average.
Have to come up with some coffee-related immigration pun, I think we should stop it there. But thank you both very
thank
much.
You.
It was very
thank you, John.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.